Let's take a look at another kingdom. Those of you in the room who are old enough to remember the comedy group, the Firesign Theater, and that would only be me and maybe Boris. There you go. Well, remember they started one of the record albums saying their protagonist, Porgy Tirebiter, had projected into the future. And they started off saying, "Welcome to the future. Everything you know is wrong." I introduce this way because everything we heard about in the last lecture doesn't happen in plants. And yet still, they undergo morphogenesis. So we're going to have a different view of life here in plants. Now, Boris told me that I had to align my talk not only to the students, but to the physicists in the audience. And so I want to point out for the physicists that my laboratory is a scam because we study soft, condensed, active matter, which is what we do. Now, here's the other thing that's different from the last talk. If you look at the mass of organisms on Earth, there's David Attenborough, that little gray thing. And there's what's really here. And so we're going to be talking about this, which is most of life on Earth. And we'll leave the little other parts for the rest of the course.
What are the two axes?
It's just an area plot. There are no axes. Okay. It's simply an area plot in which the area of this octagon represents that 450 gigatons of carbon on Earth are in plants, and all life on Earth is 550 gigatons of carbon. For those of you who are interested in global warming and in climate change, there's about 800 gigatons of carbon in the atmosphere right now. And so the plants have a lot to do with that, both taking it up through photosynthesis and putting it out through weathering away of tree trunks and things like that. These other things don't have much to do with it. So if you're worried about global climate change, start working on plants.
What about the caucus, the oceanic marine organisms? There are many of them.
There's a lot of them, but the cells are really little. Nope, they don't add up. About maybe a little less than half the photosynthesis on Earth is due to marine organisms, and they deposit carbon down into the sediments. That's certainly true, and they play a major role in global carbon cycling. But as far as massive life on Earth, they don't add up to that much because most of it's down there. Okay, so this is a slide I borrowed from Henrik Jonsson, and since we're talking about morphogenesis, I want to talk about how to generate shape and how we do it in plants. Of course, there's gene regulation of stem cells. There's mechanics in growth. These are both regulated by and regulate hormones, the morphogens that Boris talked about. And there's also interactions between cell division and hormones and mechanics in growth. And what I'm going to talk about today, now, we call this field computational morphodynamics. And what I want to do is start with an introduction to plant growth, which I was asked to do. So there's part zero, and I'll try and keep that brief. Then we'll talk about how shape controls growth, and growth creates shape in the plant world, very different from the way it's done in the animal world. Then we'll talk about how mechanics can control morphogen transport. So we'll talk about something related to Turing mechanisms, but diffusion is only a small part of it, because the morphogens aren't diffusing, they're being actively transported. And then if there's time, and I'm not sure there will be time, I'll talk about mechanics and the cell wall and how those control cell division, which is another aspect of plant morphogenesis that will be unfamiliar to the people in the animal world, though there may be some ideas you get from it. Here's the plant I'll be talking about for the most part, though if there's really time, at the very end I'll show one slide of a different sort of organism in which everything that I say in today's lecture will be wrong. And everything in the animals will also be wrong. It's something else again, but only if we get that far. So here's Arabidopsis. There's some roots being pulled out of the soil. It's a little mustard plant that people use because it's easy to use in the laboratory, like a Drosophila. And they're rosette leaves and a stem, and when the plant gets old enough, it makes some flowers and reproduces. here's a textbook view of a plant, which is exactly the same as the picture I just showed you, with some of the parts named. And there's lots of names of these parts. And if we focused in, there would be more names. And if we focused in further, there would be more names. And we're going to skip as much of that as possible, unless it's necessary to describe things, because botanic old terminology is endless, although lots of fun. Now, the place we're going to start, and the difference between what we heard about with the animals and the plants, is with the plant cell, because there's a fundamental difference between plant cells and animal cells, which has to do with the number of megapascals of pressure that it takes to deform them. It's as simple as that. Now, cells, of course, were discovered in plants, as were nuclei and genes and cytoplasm and all those other things. And by Hook, and here's the first microscope diagrams of plant cells, and here's an actual electron micrograph of some plant cells in a region of the plant we'll be talking about in a minute, which is the pseudapical meristem. And it has the usual things in it. There's a nucleus and a nucleolus. There's a bunch of little vesicles. There's some Golgi. But the thing I want to emphasize is the cell wall that surrounds the plant. Now, each of these cells is under considerable turgor pressure. This cell, before we killed it, was probably under 10 atmospheres of pressure. Something like a high-pressure bicycle tire. A bottle of champagne is 3 atmospheres. And so they're really under a lot of pressure, and that pressure is, for the most part, restrained. We'll talk about why I say for the most part restrained by a cell wall that surrounds each cell, which is no thicker than the extracellular matrix that surrounds an animal cell, but it's much stiffer. The elastic modulus is much higher. And so the same amount of stress creates much less strain, and so that these cells are blown up as tight as can be, like balloons, and the balloons are in cardboard boxes that prevent them from expanding. Now, another aspect of the cell surface that's different from animals that probably won't come up much in this talk, but you should be aware, is that all these cells connect to each other from endoplasmic reticulum through to endoplasmic reticulum, and a little bit from cytoplasm to cytoplasm through structures called plasmodesmata. And there's a picture of one going right through the cell wall from inside this cell to that cell, and small molecules can pass back and forth between these cells. One implication of which is that the turgor pressure in these cells is probably pretty much the same, because water can pass back and forth between them. Although there's some disagreement about that in the field, I think that's pretty certain. Here's a textbook picture of a plant cell, and there's our plasmodesmata so that you can see the word, and our cell wall, and all the usual other things, although plants also have chloroplasts, the second endosymbiotic event after acquisition of the mitochondria, so that they have one type of organelle that's not found in animals. Now, the cell wall structure will come into our discussions in a minute, and so I want to introduce it with this picture, which shows it's supposed to be a bilayer lipid bilayer plasma membrane down here, taken from the internet, of course, and the middle lamella, which is a thing that glues the two walls from two adjacent cells together in a primary cell wall. There isn't much to it. Inside the wall, it's made of a mixture of proteins and carbohydrates. They're glycoproteins with lots of sugars on them, which are not depicted here, called arabinogalactan proteins, and they're pectins, which are those things that make your jelly gel and serve a similar function in the wall. They make your jelly gel when the pH is right and when the calcium concentration is right. And there's some aspects of that in the cell wall, which, if we really get going a long way, I'll get to. The main stiffness of the wall is contributed by cellulose fibrils, which probably have 18 glycan chains in a crystalline form, which are laid out by cellulose synthase complexes that I'll describe in a second, from inside the cell to outside the cell. And these have a very high elastic modulus, about half that of steel. They don't have a yield strength of steel. You can rip them up, but they're very stiff. So that these are the molecules that are thought to be primarily resisting the turgor pressure, though pectins play a role too, and we may get to that. Here's a more realistic view of the cell wall than that one, in which the cellulose was emphasized. Even here, the cellulose fibrils are much thicker than they really are in a wall, and there are many more layers of them in a wall than are seen here. But these are the cellulose fibrils, and then many other types of of sugars, different sugars and different types of linkages that link the cellulose fibrils to each other and that link these different carbohydrates to each other. And there's our cellulose synthase complex, which sits in the plasma membrane and projects cellulose out through the plasma membrane. There are these hexamer rosettes thought to project 18 glucose chains or cellulose chains out in, and then they crystallize out in the cell wall to make these essentially beams, which have a very strong tensional.
The beams are really at right angles?
No, this picture is just baloney. I actually could show you what they really look like, but I don't think we'll have enough time. If we have enough time at the end, I'll show you a cryo-electron tomography going through Z sections of what the cellulose fibrils really look like. And no, they don't look like this at all.
How long are the cellulose fibrils?
I don't know. It's known, but I don't know. It's totally known. One other thing to say about the plant cell wall before we finish our introduction is that they don't divide like animal cells. And an animal cell will pinch off, as we saw, with some sort of thing that involves actin and myosin, and the membranes will fuse, and then you'll have two cells. But what you have in a plant cell is, first of all, a cortical array of microtubules, which sit just under the plasma membrane in the cytoplasm and wrap in a helical array around the cell. We'll come back to that in a second. And at the ends, there are no particular array in these sorts of elongated cells. Just before division, these microtubules seem to collect together around the middle of the cell in what's called the pre-prophase band, and that determines the position of the next cell wall. Then there's a mitosis where you get a spindle form just like in animal cells, and the chromosomes go to two sides. And the microtubules here, which are in the middle of the cytoplasm and perpendicular to the pre-prophase band, direct vesicles full of cell wall material to this middle region, the middle region where the pre-prophase band used to be and which defines where the new cell wall will be, because if you take a forceps and you pull up on that a little, the new wall will be like that. And so there's some memory of where this used to be, which is not understood. These vesicles collect in the middle there. They fuse together to make a new cell plate, and then you have two cells with some sort of cell wall material in the middle there, which we may also get back to if there's time. And then so you have two cells, but there's no pinching off. There's just a new wall put in, new framework, new drywall, new wall. Yeah?
So the way you're describing it now, I'm really puzzled why the community is still debating if cells divide across the shortest axis or if mechanical stresses, which are known to align cortical microtubules, are driving the cell division plane.
I'll get to that, and the latter is correct.
Okay.
The former is wrong. I'll show you the cells. we published that, as you well know, more than 10 years ago.
Still, like, seems to be discussed, so I'm just puzzled. Yeah.
Well, I mean, they're still arguing over things that were settled 100 years ago. There are people who think the Earth is flat. There are people who think Darwin was wrong. Who's to say? I don't know who it was that said it, but, you know, these theories only die when the people who hold them die. You just have to wait. The turnover time of bad ideas in science, as Langmuir showed by calculation, was it has a half-life of 10 years for a really bad idea that's obviously wrong in science. He gave a lecture on it. We could go through the quantitation. He was a good physicist. Just a bit about embryogenesis, but I won't be talking about this at all. I just want to describe the body of the plant and how plants grow very briefly so that we can come on to how morphogenesis occurs. And these are some pictures of different stages in plant embryogenesis. There's just like an animal, there's an egg cell. There's some other cells that surround the cells, which have lovely names like synergids. There's some other cells. There's a fertilization event in which a pollen tube grows in and drops not one, but multiple nuclei into the egg sac. One of them fertilizes the egg. The other fertilization occurs to make endosperm. We're not going to talk about that. So there's a dual fertilization. That's been known since the 1890s and is correct. Melchior Troib is the guy who found that. And then what happens is there's a few divisions which make a long linear thing. The bottom part is a nutritive tissue called a suspensor, and it doesn't survive in the final mature plant. The top part is the proembryo, and it grows at first in a globular fashion. There's some cell divisions. We're seeing it here just after the epidermal layer is established by these periclinal divisions. The initial divisions are anticlinal, that is, the wall is perpendicular to the surface, and periclinal, the wall is parallel to the surface. Then two cotyledons get established as a result of some transport of hormones related to something we'll talk about in a few minutes. They continue to grow out, and these cells continue to divide till you have an embryo. It flops over, and there's the two cotyledons. And I want to emphasize three tissues here. So this is what's inside a seed. When the seed pops out, these cotyledons open up and start to photosynthesize. This tip starts to grow down into a root, into the soil, and you get a plant. The way you get a plant isn't that anything special other than the initial photosynthesis and storage of starch and oils occurs in these cotyledons, or storage organs, and initially functional organs, but rather there are three populations of cells that contribute the entire after germination: the shoot apical meristem, the cambium, and the root apical meristem. So three collections of stem cells which have different behaviors. The shoot apical meristem, which it's all I'm going to be talking about today, gives rise to the stem, the leaves, the flowers, everything above ground. The root apical meristem gives rise to almost everything above ground. It gives rise to the roots, which can branch in various ways. Root branches grow out by the formation of new meristems. New shoot apical meristems also form every time a leaf is made, and we'll get to this. There's a new shoot apical meristem that forms in the axil of that leaf, which can grow out in the right environmental circumstances and give a branch. That branch has leaves, and those branches can grow out, hence the fractal form of trees. And this can go on for a long time.
The scale of this thing is about a millimeter, or what are they?
Less. This is a Rhabdopsis embryo. I don't know. How big is it, Dominique? Couple of hundred microns.
Okay. Yeah. Tens.
Yeah, that's right.
Can you remind us of the relative ploidy of the different cell types at this stage?
They're all diploid. The endosperm that surrounds this thing, that did surround it before it was all eaten up, it was triploid, but it's gone by the mature stage.
So the apparent difference in nuclear size here doesn't reflect ploidy?
No, not as far as we know. Which is also true in the cell cycle of all organisms. The size of the nucleus doesn't correspond to how much DNA is in there, oddly enough. But no, in this case, as far as I know, they're all diploid. Some of them become polyploid later. So the root meristem makes the root, and then the cambium causes widening of the vascular system and therefore widening the stem. So here's a root meristem. It's a little group of cells at the bottom, and it's bifacial. So the cells in the middle divide. Some of them push down to make a root cap, which grows into the soil and has some functions, among which are lubrication, and so that it kind of gets torn off as the root goes through the soil, as does some of the epidermis. Then these cells divide to make files of cells, which are continually produced. So these are the younger cells, and these are the older cells. They elongate and differentiate as they come up from the meristem and end up making the various parts of the root. The cambium is the stem cell population that's around the stem. So you have a primary stem that gets formed in the embryo, and then it expands by, again, bifacial expansion. Let's see if we have a picture here. So that these cells divide. On their inside, they make more xylem, which conducts water and gets strong secondary walls and are dead cells once they differentiate. And on the outside, they make phloem. And the phloem is another nutrient transport system where the sugars and things like that go. And in a tree, the phloem dies every year, and this goes out and makes more xylem, and you get new phloem. And so the bark is dead phloem and continually peels off. And the xylem increments, and the older xylem is the heartwood, and the newer xylem is the sapling. So that when you cut through a tree, or if this were made out of wood instead of plastic, it would be made out of xylem. The rest of the lecture is going to be about the shoot apical meristem. Why? Because that's what I work on. There's lots also known about the root meristems and about the cambium. And we can make the same points from looking at those. So this is a coleus plant taken from a textbook, and coleus is the usual one represented in textbooks because it has a big shoot apical meristem that can be different sizes. and this is the shoot apex, after germination and after the plant starts growing. So what the shoot apical meristem does is it has a bunch of dividing cells. The ultimate stem cells are at the top. We'll get to that in a minute. There are cells on the side that are the sites for the formation of new organs, initially leaves and then later flowers. And these are new leaves coming up right here from the sides of the meristem. And at the bottom of the meristem, it pours down cells that eventually become new vasculature, which then gets widened by cambium when it gets a little bit older. And so we have here the formation of new meristems and the axils of leaves as they form. So these can form branches, and they'll behave just like the initial primary shoot apical meristem behaves. And so that's the way a plant grows. Up from the shoot apical meristem, down from the root apical meristem, and out from the cambium.
What does the color represent here?
The color here represents the stain that was used for this microscopic picture, which in this particular picture I think is Toluidin blue, O, which is a metachromatic stain that makes some cells look purple and some cells look blue for reasons that are not known. Yeah?
These axillary meristems, do they break off from the shoot apical meristem, or are they
separate systems that develop on their own? That's another thing that's been controversial, but I think it's entirely clear. Now, there may be a little bit of residual gene expression of a gene called STM that stays on in these things from the original meristem, but pretty much they form de novo, much like you can get them to form. And if you dice up a plant, you just grow it in culture, you can regenerate the plant, and new shoot apical meristems form de novo. So we know that can happen. Yeah?
So do I understand correctly that there's this sort of 3D mass of cells just underneath the shoot that eventually turns into a cylindrical shell of the cambium, right?
Yep.
And presumably there is some transition where it encounters xylem or whatever, the dead part of xylem.
Well, what happens is that there's already xylem down here in the older parts and vasculature, and new vasculature forms from these leaves and goes down and connects to it.
So does the xylem come up all the way to the apex?
Yeah, eventually. Well, it doesn't come all the way to the shoot apex. It comes up all the way through these leaves. But no, it does not come all the way up to the shoot apex. It starts a little bit below. You can't see it here.
Okay. But there is a transition, I'm trying to be for scale,
Okay. It's 50 micron. Yeah, it's a big one. The shoot apical meristem here is, I mean, they're typically 50 to a couple of hundred microns across and have a few hundred cells. And that's true in Arabidopsis. It's true in a redwood. A redwood all comes from a shoot apical meristem, just like an Arabidopsis plant does. But a Arabidopsis plant does it in 3 or 4 weeks, and a redwood takes 1,000 years to get that. Here's the Arabidopsis shoot apical meristem in a scanning electron microscope view. These individual cells are about 5 microns across. And those are the exact cells. I showed you a section through here showing that cuboidal shell with the cell walls, and that's what these have. And this is at a time in the plant's life when it's making flowers, so it's already been induced to flower. And these are the early flower primordia forming, which later will elaborate floral organs like sepals, petals, stamens, and carpels, and we won't get that far today, I don't think. So here's a shoot apical meristem segmented into its cells, so you can see there's a few hundred cells in there with their flowers, and we can segment and leaf through the thing in a confocal microscope, as we will, and so we can know plenty about shoot apical meristems. To emphasize the size, there's something I took from the internet of a thread going through the eye of a needle. And at the same scale, there's the Arabidopsis shoot apical meristem. So an Arabidopsis shoot apical meristem isn't much different in width from one of your hairs, although it depends what kind of hair you have, because human hair is variable. So they're very small, but lots of cell division over and lots of cell enlargement over lots of time can give you as big of a plant as you want. There's two sets of terminology to describe the cells in the shoot apical meristem that I want to introduce because I may slip into it and because it's important for how the meristem works. And what we'll be talking about from now on is how the meristem is controlled to create different shapes and different sorts of organs in the plant. The meristem can be divided conceptually. This slide is not a stain, it's Photoshop fraud, where I've colored blue what's called the rib meristem, I've colored green what's called the peripheral zone, and the central zone I've colored red. The central zone, and I made this before any of the molecular knowledge was known about this, but we now have molecular gene expression patterns that look exactly like this, as I'll show you. The central zone cells are the ultimate stem cells. All the other cells arise over time from these central zone cells, which go down several layers, as you can see, and which have their own patterns of gene expression, and which are the pluripotent stem cells of the shoot apex. As they divide, they create on their sides, and we'll talk about the division planes in a second, this peripheral zone, and these cells keep growing up away from the peripheral zone they've made. In the peripheral zone, the new organs, leaves or flowers are formed, and the meristem is traditionally defined as whatever's above these little crotches between the last formed organs. So that it's not meaningful in a molecular sense. And then there's the rib meristem, where the planes of cell division are somewhat different, and these provide these ribs or files of cells that go down and make the stem. So we have growth, where this, like a frozen fountain, keeps growing up away from the cells it's deposited behind and going higher and higher during the life of the plant. There's a second way you can characterize the cells of the shoot apical meristem, which is by layers, layer 1, layer 2, and corpus. Because the epidermal cells, which are the L1 cells, and the subepidermal cells, which are the L2 cells, typically in the meristem have only anticlinal cell divisions and no periclinal cell divisions. And so this epidermis is a clone from the embryo, and these cells dividing and some continued division here and here continues to provide an epidermis, but this epidermal cell is a sister to that epidermal cell, but this epidermal cell is unrelated to the adjacent L2 cell, which was established when the periderm was formed at the 16-cell stage of the embryo, and since then, these two lineages don't mix. And these cells also divide anticlinally until they start to make organs, and then you can get some periclinal divisions, and there's additional periclinal divisions can occur in the formation of a flower, or in the, do occur in the formation of a leaf. And then in the corpus, which is the rest of the cells, they can divide in any plane. So you have two layers that sit on top of this and a bunch of cells underneath. And this structure is how it is. And we could probably go outside and find evidence of this by looking at horticultural variants where the L2 cells are mutant and they're vegetatively propagated. So they've been mutant for hundreds of years while the L1 and the L3 are wild type. These are albino. So some of the green tissue in the leaf is replaced by white tissue. The L2 derivatives are white. And you get these variegated looking leaves, which campus horticulture departments really like to plant all over campuses. So for sure we can find some if we went looking. And they show the incredible stability of these cell division patterns. Although sometimes you get a periclinal division and you get a little branch that's all white and those don't grow very far. Or you get a little branch that's all green and they come out every spring and cut those off.
So since L1 and L2 are defined early on, does it mean that you can target, a growth regulator to one or the other and make one layer?
Oh, totally, yeah. Yeah, we can CRISPR L1 only. I'll tell you how to do that. Oh, yeah, for
so
sure.
Do they have to be
you can change the genotypes of one at a time.
So is the growth tightly coordinated, or so extra cells just go periclinal?
No, it's tightly coordinated in the meristem. You almost never see a periclinal division. In fact, you never see a periclinal division. You know they occur because of the way these mosaics sometimes break through. Yeah?
What's the profile of cell division rate along the...
These are slower. Maybe divide about once every 24 hours, 12 to 24, 18 to 24. These are a little bit faster, dividing about every 12 hours. And then once you get up here, they're faster yet. Here they are dividing, but we're only looking at the L1 here. And so while these are stately objects and these cells are ordinarily dividing only about once a day, over the course of the 3 days in which we took this movie, all but one of these cells divide. some bright-eyed student in the class will find the one that doesn't. And then these flower primordia, which are coming out from the peripheral zone, are growing faster. They have faster cell divisions, and so they project out. And of course, you can follow the patterns of gene expression in all of these things, in the meristem and in the new flowers as they start to develop, as you will with live confocal imaging, which I believe will be a part of this course, if Sebastian gets his microscope made in time. Now, there are basically two patterns of gene expression in the shoot apical meristem, and after describing those, I'm going to get on and talk about some experiments. The two patterns are gene expression relative to the meristem, like this, which is a marker for the central zone cells. It's a gene that Clavata 3, it's a gene that encodes a peptide, which is secreted from the cells, which diffuses in the cell wall to act as a signaling molecule. And the predominant mode of chemical communication between cells in a plant is peptide signaling. There are about 10 small molecule hormones that are involved in signaling between cells that are very important, and we'll talk about one or more of those as time goes on. But most signaling is with peptides, which bind to the extracellular domains of transmembrane receptor kinases, which are of the serine threonine kinase class. Though some of them do phosphorylate tyrosines, evolutionarily they're derived from the serine threonine kinases. The evolutionary subfamily of tyrosine kinases that's so important in animals isn't found in plants. In these serine threonine kinases, the peptides, the number of peptides in the genome isn't known. There's at least a few hundred. And the number of transmembrane receptor kinases in the Arabidopsis genome is something like 300 to 500. So there's lots of signals going on. Now, not all of it is cell-to-cell signaling. Pathogens also signal through some of these kinases, so that peptides or small protein fragments, say, from the flagellum of a Pseudomonas bacterium, will activate a specific one of these transmembrane receptor kinases that projects out of the epidermal cells and activate an immune response. So some of them are involved in immunity and some are involved in cell-cell communication. But they're the predominant mode of communication between plant cells. The second pattern, so these patterns are relative to the meristem. Wuschel is a transcription factor that's regulated by Clavata 3 working through a receptor kinase called Clavata 1. And Wuschel also moves, and this is another principle to establish for some of this plant cell. This is an extracellular protein that diffuses through the apoplast, which is the formal name for the outside of the cell wall, which doesn't present much of a barrier to diffusion of modestly sized molecules. So this can diffuse. In fact, it diffuses through the whole meristem, as has been shown. Now, Wuschel is a transcription factor. We've made the reporter show up in cytoplasm, but it's a nuclear protein normally. And Wuschel, like many proteins in plants, goes through plasmodesmata from cell to cell. So the place where you find the RNA, which is down here, is different from where you'd find the protein, which includes all of these cells up here, because there's what's called symplastic transport from cell to cell, without going out and diffusing in the cell wall, but going through the plasmodesmata. So there are two pathways of communication in these cells. There's peptides and other extracellular molecules which can diffuse in the apoplast, and there are proteins and some RNAs which can move in the symplast from cell to cell. And so where the gene is expressed isn't necessarily where the protein is found, or for that matter, where the RNA has to be found. And so keep that in mind. But of course, you can see all that. And here's another example of a gene expressed in the peripheral zone relative to the meristem. Now, these gene expression patterns, since the meristem is always dividing and growing, have a boundary, and when a cell divides, one of the daughter cells can stop expressing the central zone markers and start to express peripheral zone markers, and this boundary can go either way. There are ways that you can make cells that are already multipotent stem cells in the peripheral zone turn back into central zone cells, and ways that central zone cells will become peripheral cells, which they normally do as they grow out. And so the boundary between those type of cells is not hard, and it's regulated at all times. So the cells are dividing, and these patterns of gene expression are stable against a background of dividing cells. In fact, you can't imagine anything more stable than the expression of Clavata 3 and Wuschel in a shoot apical meristem, because they're expressed about 5 micrometers apart where the genes are activated. And that's true in all the dicotyledonous plants, which have been diverging since the Cretaceous, 140 million years ago. So this domain of gene expression hasn't even moved 5 microns in 140 million years, which is the same amount of time in which America has moved from Europe all the way across the Atlantic Ocean. And so they talk about the geological pace of things. That's nothing compared to the evolutionary pace.
So if you damage this region, does it recover then?
Sure does. Oh, yeah. I didn't bring a bunch of slides about that, but oh, yeah, it's super cool. It totally, I mean, it recovers lots of ways. The dead cells just get left behind, and it keeps growing up. But the cells also will respecify in lots of ways. Here's another example that shows, it implies that that could happen, which is that the meristem can be at different sizes, and these domains scale with the size of the meristem. And it's nutritional state that will scale the size of the meristem by changing the rates of cell division. So you feed them more nitrate or phosphate, they'll get bigger, and these domains scale with the size of the meristem. And there's a story there, too, that I also won't be telling. The other pattern of gene expression is with the new primordia. And this is a gene we'll talk about later, but it happens to be induced by a hormone that's active in the newly forming primordia. And so everywhere where a new flower primordium is forming, you get brighter expression of it. And so that's the second gene expression pattern, is relative to primordia, not relative to meristem. And that's pretty much it for genes, which have nothing to do with anything that I'm going to talk about from here on out, because we all grew up hearing that genes did everything in development, but not in any of the cases I'm going to talk about. All right. There's one other thing to mention that I'll come back to later. Gene expression's not everything. And so if you just tap a meristem on the side and look at the calcium levels in the cytoplasm, there are all kinds of waves that propagate across the meristem. These cells know they've been hit. They're mechanically responsive. And this doesn't have anything to do with changes in gene activity. It takes 2 minutes. And so there are lots of responses of plant cells, just like responses of animal cells, to mechanical forces, which is what I'll be emphasizing, that don't have anything to do with gene activity changes, only to do with machines that genes set up that are sitting there and functioning. And it's those machines that create the morphogenesis and don't have much to do with changing patterns of gene expression or transcription or any of those other things your developmental biology colleagues drone on about endlessly. We're going to get to the heart of this. Forget genes.
We're actually seeing seconds on that clock?
Minutes. The one is minute, yeah. So that's, where was that? Yeah, those are seconds. That's correct. So it's a slow intercellular calcium wave. Quite slow. I can tell you why it's slow, but we're never going to get there. At the rate I'm going, we're never going to get through any of this. Okay, let's go to story number one. Shape controls growth. Growth creates shape. Now, one thing to know about the epidermal cells of a plant is that they're under tension. Not only tension from the turgor pressure, but tension because the turgor in the underlying L2 and L3 cells is not fully resisted by their walls. And so that if you were to free those cells, they would expand a little bit. They're not at their elastic resting state. They're a little compressed, the walls. The epidermal cells are under tension. So the springs are sprung out. And they have viscoelastic properties, but they're not doing the viscous here. They're just under tension. And they resist the turgor pressure that's residual from the underlying cells. And this has been known since 1859, when Hofmeister, or Sachs in the 1860s, took a razor blade and cut up through the middle of a dandelion stem. And it does that, as you well know. And that's because the epidermal cells are under tension and other cells expand a little bit and curl it up. That's important because it means when you look at a shoot apical meristem, you can use thin wall pressure vessel calculations, like in freshman mechanics, and calculate the patterns of stress, the second order tensor field of stress. And so we're already beyond the scalar and the vector in Boris's lecture, and we're up to the second order tensor field. We'll get to the fourth order tensor field in a second when we add strain, and so we'll be at the same type of tensor field that describes space-time. We can calculate the stresses, and even I can calculate that in a cylinder, the stress is twice as much that way in a thin-walled pressure vessel as it is this way. Which is why if you have an unreinforced gas cylinder and it explodes, the break is this way. That's why these things were first calculated by Cauchy and Euler and people like that. It was to decide which way the steam engine tanks were going to blow. which way to reinforce them, or at least how to aim them away from management toward the workers. It's in a spherical or a hemispherical area. You notice they're always stood up, so they blow out to the feet. They don't blow up to the offices. And okay, so these days we reinforce them. In a spherical or hemispherical area, all the stresses are the same in all directions. So we have anisotropic stress that results from shape and isotropic stress in some regions. And so we can calculate the stress in a shoot apical meristem with its flower primordium as being isotropic in the meristematic region, anisotropic in these saddle points between meristems and new primordia, such that there's high tensional forces across this valley region and lower tensional and potentially even compressional forces orthogonal to that. And it turns out that the microtubule cytoskeleton in the plants exactly reflects this. So the microtubules in these helical arrays that I introduced before realign hour by hour to be in different patterns. And in these isotropic regions, they just continue to do that. But in anisotropic regions, they do not realign. They stay aligned and bundled and parallel to the principal direction of maximal stress. So the cytoskeleton responds to mechanics. We can calculate the stress pattern from shape because the epidermis is under tension, and that stress pattern matches the microtubules. And around the cylindrical part, there's less bundling, but still some degree of alignment circumferential to the stem. This is what they actually look like. So there's one of those valley points, and you can see the microtubules all lined up. And you can see there's no preferential direction. Once you get to the middle, and if you get around out to here, they tend to be aligned with the stress pattern. It is stress. If you just poke a hole in the meristem, you can watch the microtubules realign so that they become circumferential. Remember, this is under tension, so the hole's expanding. So the stress pattern now becomes anisotropic around the hole, and within a couple of hours, the microtubules all realign. So it is stress, and it's not wounding. Here's a vice that Yves Coudert made, that if you knew Yves, great guy, and so that we could squeeze the meristem and then release it. And we'd squeeze it before, and then while it's squeezed, you can realign the microtubules to the principal direct, the maximal stress, tensional direction of stress, and do it reversibly without injury. Now, the reason this is important for the plant comes back to cellulose. The cellulose synthase complexes ride along the microtubules as tracks. So that these cortical microtubules are right under the plasma membrane. These cellulose synthase complexes get delivered to the surface in these big Golgi vesicles that people in the back row can see. And then once they're delivered, they move along the microtubules, which are these little tiny green spots that the people in the front row can see, in either direction, no preferential direction, and they just move along the microtubules. So they deposit cellulose through the plasma membrane, cellulose with its high elastic modulus, out into the cell wall, parallel to the principal maximal direction of stress. And therefore, the stress is resisted by making the wall anisotropic. And here's our key to morphogenesis, then, is an anisotropic cell wall where the anisotropy is dictated by stress and where the stress pattern is dictated by the shape of the tissue. So it's not a readout to shape where we're forming shape, we're taking the shape and we're reading it in to the activity of the cell wall biosynthetic machinery. And then if we look at the cellulose, it matches the predicted stress patterns. I'm going to skip that. And if we prevent the microtubules from being polymerized by adding some arisolin instead of a tip like this growing, and we've treated with something to prevent flower primordia from forming, the cells don't divide anymore because we've depolymerized the microtubules, and they expand. They get 120 degree angles between them like soap bubbles, and they don't retain the shape. And you can model this. In this case, we've got stress-resisted parallel to the stress direction, and we get normal growth. And in this case, we're having stress-resisted orthogonal to the stress direction, and you get balloon-like growth. And so this stress feedback retains the shape and creates the shape, because as this grows, the stress pattern changes, the cellulose deposition changes, and we get a new shape. And then the new shape is read in to create the next shape. And so the cells don't know much. They're plant cells. They're as dumb as bricks. They resemble bricks in a lot of ways. But because of this mechanism, they know what shape tissue they're in, and they can create a new shape tissue if you change the mechanism or alter it. And so you have a machine here that reads in stress, reads out to direction of growth, anisotropic growth, and I should emphasize that when the cellulose is wound around a cell like this, the cell only expands this way, so that it's twisted out like a spring. The cellulose fibrils end up at an angle like this, but it doesn't expand much this way because the cellulose fibrils have a high elastic modulus, so the wall is anisotropic and it's more pliable in this direction and in this direction. So the future expansion of the cells is dictated by the stress pattern, but the stress pattern is dictated by the prior expansion of the cells. Yeah?
The shape is changing.
Yeah, change all the time.
But wouldn't you, so, but is the shape of the shoot in the plant not the same over days and weeks? Like, it's growing, but the shape is growing. So what's missing that keeps the shape constant? So this was
nothing's missing. This is it. Just this stress feedback. I mean, over days and weeks, it takes days for these cells to divide. This is a slow process.
But it's becoming more and more tipped. Like
I don't think
pointy.
So. No, you're just oops. I don't think the shape of that is changing at all. Actually, I mean, you're getting stem below it, but I don't think that parabola is changing. Maybe it is. I don't know. Any event, this is what you get if you just do an FEM model and you put the stress feedback in it.
So it sounds like once you sort of shift from isotropic to anisotropic, it's kind of a set on the course, right? Because then there is a stress field very much strongly in it. But how can they enforce it?
Of course, because the cellulose gets laid down, and once the cellulose is fully laid down, resisting the stress, it's isotropic again. Remember, the wall's anisotropic too. And so once you, if you wait a few days, the microtubules go back to all over the place in those valleys.
But there will be layers of cell wall, which is always,
No, actually not. It's not understood, but it's been known since the 1930s that the only cellulose that really matters is the recently synthesized cellulose. The other stuff doesn't matter. Why not? I don't know. Nobody knows, but it's true, and it's well demonstrated. Yeah. So good point in the dynamics of this whole thing. But yeah, they'll go back to isotropic once the wall is fully anisotropic.
And all the new cell walls are horizontal in the picture, in the movie on the left.
Yeah, because we're looking at the epidermis, and so it's only anticlinal divisions. Yep. But that's not true farther down. Yeah. Of course, we don't know whether this stress mechanism is occurring farther down, because our microscopes don't see very many layers down to see the microtubules.
So you have a well-defined model, and presumably a few parameters, and this finite element simulation going. So did people look at the stability of everything? You know, it gets to be a rather complex dynamical system. Are there instabilities? Do these, physics, you do a thing like this, and then you vary the parameter, and you'll find that, okay, there's this nice, right, Ken was just asking, you know, is it going to a stable sort of propagating traveling.
I think for a simple shape like the one we showed, the answer is that it's stable and that you can change your parameters a fair bit. When you get to more complicated shapes, we're not so sure.
Okay, but fair bit is a question. So if you just take one parameter and start tweaking it, for example, does it start oscillating?
I don't know. Tamsin, you know?
That's typically the first instability that would happen.
Do you know? The models are done in Henrik Janssen's lab, and Tamsin's in Henrik's lab, so she knows more about this than I do. He'll be here at the end of the course asking. Okay. I'm sure he's explored the parameter space on some of these models. And
just related to a naive question, so can you make this thing branch by just applying the right kinds of stresses?
Well, I think you could if you artificially made, restrained it across the top of the meristem. I think it would start to bifurcate, but that's not how the plant actually branches. At least not how this plant actually branches. There are other plants that might, but not this one. Okay, so stress is generated by, this is lesson one, stress is generated by tissue shape and an epidermis and tension. This mechanical stress controls the cytoskeleton, thus the cellulose anisotropy. Cellulose controls the subsequent cell expansion, which in turn changes the stress pattern. And so tissue shape is sensed locally by cells, leading to future changes in tissue shape. Now, when Einstein died, Wheeler wrote an obituary for him in the memoirs of the National Academy of Sciences, and he summarized Einstein's gravity theory with gravity changes the shape of space, space changes gravity. It's the same thing. And this is also a fourth order tensor field, stress and strain. So it's just Einstein's gravitational theory rewritten in a shoot apical meristem. A couple more things to say about this. I'll return to the mechanism of the microtubule realignment later if there's time and tell you what we know about it, but accept it as a fact. Now, one bit to know about the mechanism is that if you have an oddly shaped cell, like this pavement cell from a leaf surface, which is under high turgor pressure, you can predict a stress pattern in an individual cell, and these are the first and second principal directions of stress. The red is first and green is second, and when they about the same length, the stress is isotropic, and it's anisotropic from these necks to necks. It's isotropic in the regions between the lobes, and the microtubules follow that exactly. That's the von Mies stress for the people who like that stuff, which isn't a stress, it's unitless. And so that the microtubules can align in a subcellular fashion. It's not a whole cell at a time. And in this type of cell, because of its shape, the stress pattern is primarily dictated by the cell shape. But if you ablate a cell with a laser in this epidermis of a leaf, and these are stomata that I think we'll be hearing about later, but these are the pavement cells between them, you can see the microtubules realign to be circumferential to the whole because this epidermis is also under tension. And so you go from a domain where the alignment is subcellular to a domain where the alignment is supracellular because the stress, the relevant stress, is turgor in an oddly shaped cell before you make the hole, but after you make the hole, the epidermal tension becomes the dominant stress. So you can go from a subcellular to a supracellular organization of the cytoskeleton based on the stress pattern. Of course, he's formulating a question. He's getting ready.
Yeah, no, I'm just staring at the... So am I supposed to see that the next color blatant shape of cell, the shape of the boundary changes, or it doesn't
No, the
change?
Shape of the boundary doesn't change very much.
So
it gets a little bit bigger. You can see this. You can see this lobe retracting a little bit, and this one retracting a little bit.
Which is pretty surprising, right? Because presumably you blasted the neighboring cell, and there's no more turgor pressure there.
Okay. We didn't do anything to the L2 cells. So now they're getting stretched underneath and preventing the hole from exploding. If you cut it with a scissors, you get it really springs out, and the microtubules seriously align to either side of the wound, and you really get a lot of movement if you cut it with a scissors, which is the evidence that it's the L2 and lower cells that are holding it together in this experiment, where we only pop the top cell. And we have pictures. There's a paper where we cut it with scissors, and we showed how much it springs out. Yeah?
How much anisotropy can this microtubule network detect in the mechanism that you're proposing? So, you know, I've got my principal curvatures and my two directions. How much of a difference does the difference need to be before I can tell that I'm at a saddle rather than a...
Less than twofold.
Less than twofold.
Yeah, and the way we know that is just looking at the shape, because it's twice as much stress this way around a cylinder, and they were aligned, as you can see, when we got down that far in the meristem. And at the top, they're not aligned, and so that's somewhere in the range of isotropic to twofold anisotropy in one direction, the microtubules are responding.
And is that somehow related to the persistence length of the microtubules?
I don't know. I doubt it, but I if there's time, we'll get back to the mechanism. But it involves a bunch of different aspects of microtubules. In particular, severing is important for this. Is if there's time, I'll show you. Now, one last thing to... Yeah?
A question about photosynthesis and how it might be controlling the rate of cellulose production, which then feeds back into stress. Is that linkage understood very well in terms of how, if you have more or less photosynthesis, you're changing the dynamics of the stress relaxation over time?
It's not understood very well, but the meristem isn't photosynthesizing. It's getting its sugars through the vascular system from the leaves, which are sources, and it's a sink. And so there's always plenty of energy. There's always plenty of sugar at the meristem. Now the plants, when they go from, say, vegetative to reproductive phase, the meristem starts to make a lot of flowers faster. Where the metabolites get partitioned to the meristem, and that metabolite partitioning is really important in crop science and is very poorly understood. But the plants direct the carbon from wherever photosynthesis is occurring. If you put these plants in the dark, well, they'll still go for a couple of days. They have plenty of starch stored. And after that, yeah, they'll stop. Yeah, third.
So how does the L2 layer change once you exit the meristem? Because in leaves, I always thought you have this pretty uniform, and I guess in the Z direction, you have a pretty uniform L1 layer. And then underneath, it's more of this kind of like spherical cells that aren't like those that their neighbors aren't completely touching each other.
Yeah. Once you get down to past the palisade layer, which is underneath the epidermis, and which is highly organized, and they're all stuck together pretty tight.
Okay. So you think it's the palisade layer?
Yeah. Up from the other end, I'm not sure. Sure, but we never looked at the backside. What's down there? Have you ever looked at the backside?
we do. I mean, it's a good question, though, because
there are air spaces between the mesophyll cells, as you pointed out. But there's a palisade layer underneath the upper side, yeah. Which is what we were zapping in that experiment, at least. Yeah, might be interesting to go back. We actually looked to see if the opening and closing of stomata had an effect on the stress pattern in the surrounding cells, but the answer is no. The stomata are at the top of little mountains mostly, and when they open, actually most of their movement is in the Z direction. We never published that. I don't believe it's widely known, but yeah.
I think in your paper you also have some things because of that. You actually have the microtubules going around.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's like a little local.
Yeah, but the opening and closing, they mostly go this way, the stomata.
Which kind of makes sense if you do have a wall. I mean, well, so you have to coordinate with my neighbors.
They're wrapped with microtubules, too. and have anisotropic walls, yeah. Anything else? Yeah?
I'm curious about the relative mechanical stress between the cell wall and the microtubule structures, and if there are any protein that directly link microtubule to cell walls to kind of sense.
Yes, there are. I bet we'll never get there, but yes, there are, including, among other things, the cellulose synthase complexes, but they're not actually the things that are transmitting the stress, because the cellulose is out in the wall, goes to those complexes, and those complexes are attached to the microtubules. But there are other things, too. There are formins that attach it to the plasma membrane. There are arabinogalactan proteins that go through the plasma membrane into the cytoplasm and do something. And if there's time, we'll get there. Oh, one other thing to point out, as you might suspect, because the plane of cell division is dictated by the microtubules, that would imply that the plane of cell division depends on the stress pattern, which it does, as I've been particularly shown in detail by these guys. But here's an experiment that we did. We just poked a hole with a needle, and if you look later, the new cell walls are all circumferential to the hole. And this has been known for 130 years, because Leopold Knie showed by squeezing equisetum spores that he could change the pattern of cell division. And then he did it again with impatience peel from Phil Lintelhack. Did it with tobacco callus, where he built a little microvise. It was pneumatic microvise. It's really cute. And so here's the way callus, tobacco pith callus, grows if you don't constrain it. But if you constrain it and then take it out of the vise, you get these files of cells, because the stress pattern dictated the pattern of cell division. So it's been known for 130 years that this is true. Now we know why it's true. All right. Let's go to number two. Mechanics can control morphogen transport. How long do I have, Boris? I have another half hour or so. I'll go late, too. I always do. See if we can get to three. But let's go to this. Another story. We're going to be talking about small molecules, not our peptides, but a small molecule called auxin, a hormone. Now, this is if you look at a shoot apical meristem in a Rhabdopsis plant, and you look down at the flowers that surround it, they're in a particular pattern, a spiral pattern where the generative angle from one primordium to the next primordium is 120 or 130 or 140 degrees. Those of you who are in physics probably have heard that it's 137.5 degrees. Oh, come on. This is biology. There's only about 20 cells around there, so it would be plus or minus 18, even if the primordium came from a single cell, which it doesn't. And this is true for leaves. You can count from older to younger here, or flowers from older to younger, and they're in a very well-defined pattern. The students in the audience will notice that one of these is a left-handed helix and one is a right-handed. It's random. And just to be sure, in case anybody asks, we took 1,000 seeds to Australia and planted them in the... And that's also random. We put that in the paper. The editors make it a famous thing. We actually did it. All right, so spiral phyllotaxis. This is something that has challenged mathematically-minded biologists for a long time, starting with Hofmeister, who made the first mathematical model of phyllotaxis, in which he showed that the new primordium came out at the position that was most distant from the last two primordia. Hofmeister was the third greatest botanist of the 19th century. He should not be forgotten. Come on.
Zach?
Yeah. Huh? No, no. Oh, for crying out loud.
No, not that Zach. The other.
You mean Van Sack? You mean
the one with the cell division?
No, he's fourth.
Brown.
Come on.
Brown?
Huh?
Brown in motion?
No, you mean the spiral tendency in organs of the nature philosopher? He's a million.
Are you thinking of the guy with Matt pollen grains as a botanist?
Yeah, he would be. No. Come on. Darwin is number one. Mendel is number two. Hofmeister is number three. The theory of evolution came from plants, partly. The theory of the cell came from plants. That was Schleiden. He might be fifth. And so the theory of the gene came from plants. All the theories we have in biology came from plants. This guy, also, I mean, when he killed himself, this what he was working on was phyllotactic pattern, and he's the one that coined the term morphogen, I think. I promised Boris I would look this up, and I was going to go to the Oxford English Dictionary. I didn't do it. So I think he did. And he invented his reaction diffusion mechanisms to explain phyllotaxis. As you'll see, I would say that's not it. Boris will say it is it, but we can have this discussion later. So here's the stuff you buy in the market. It shows a phyllotactic pattern of pattern after pattern after pattern fractally, because these are mutants where the floral primordia don't develop for a really long time. So you're seeing meristems and new meristems and then new floral primordia. And these guys also had a lot to do with it. Glenn Mitchison, phyllotaxis, the late great. Well, both these guys just died recently. Yves Couder, who simplified phyllotaxis to three equations, which described it, and was able to get inanimate objects to create phyllotactic patterns by having some wonderful experiments. But none of these reflected anything about how plants do it. Plants do it in a way that to a physicist is probably pretty dumb. The way plants make new flower primordia is, first of all, a new flower appears at a place where the plant hormone auxin reaches the highest concentration. And this has been known since the 1930s, because you can put a dab of auxin on a meristem and change the phyllotactic pattern. By Robin and Mary Snow, who did this in the 30s. So this is a fluorescent reporter of concentration of this plant hormone. The plant hormone has a number of different effects, which we'll get to in a second. In the end, when these cells are higher in auxin concentration, they'll be the positions where the next floral primordia come from. And then here are the other ones that were made previously. And so high auxin concentration creates a new primordium in the peripheral zone of the shoot apical meristem. And so to understand the phyllotactic pattern, what we have to understand is why it is that these high auxin concentration positions are spaced apart from each other in a regular fashion that approximates 130 or 140 degrees. Now, auxin is indole acetic acid. It has its own checkered history. but that's what it is, and some other related compounds. It induces new leaves and flowers, as I just said. Another thing auxin does is when you put it on shoot cells, it causes the wall to weaken, and so the cells start to expand. And that's been known since Cleland and people like that worked out the acid growth theory in the 1960s, which is that auxin activates some proton pumps, which acidify the wall by pumping protons out and using ATP, and that active acidification of the wall is thought to cause the wall to weaken for a bunch of reasons, among which are that there's some enzymes that make the wall weaker in acid conditions, but there are others. And we're not going to get very far with that if we start into how all that works. It also causes changes in gene activity through a nuclear receptor, which is a ubiquitin ligase complex or ubiquitin SCF complex that causes degradation of anti-transcription factors. And so you get transcription activated in certain genes when auxin goes in a cell. And that happens some minutes after the initial responses or coincident with the initial responses that cause cell expansion. And now auxin has a private circulatory system. Because of its weak acid nature, it's ionic in the neutral cytoplasm of a cell. And these ions, indole acetate, will not go through a plasma membrane. And so auxin is trapped in the cytoplasm of a cell and the other parts of the cell. The only way it can get out is there's a protein that lets it out called the auxin efflux carrier. And the auxin efflux carrier is a transmembrane integral membrane protein that sits in the plasma membrane and that is not uniformly distributed in cells. So that if there's only auxin efflux carrier at the bottom of each cell in a row of cells, and this was analytically worked out by Mitchison in late 70s and also computationally worked out in the whole stem by Mary Helen Goldsmith, you get a net flux of auxin downwards. If there's only efflux carrier at the bottom, you have auxin in this cell. When the auxin leaves the cell, it goes out into the wall. The wall, because of these proton pumps, is at a lower pH. Even without auxin, they're cranking. And so it gets reassociated with its proton, and that now neutral molecule can diffuse through the plasma membrane. So it can diffuse back into the cell of origin, which isn't shown very badly, isn't shown in this review article, or into the next cell. If it diffuses into the next cell, it can't get out till it gets to the bottom. So you get a net flow of this hormone. So auxin is the morphogen that creates flowers, but it's not freely diffusing. It is freely diffusing, but it also has superimposed on that diffusion a directional transport mechanism.
So did you say it also creates leaves?
Yeah.
And how does it know to do leaf versus flower? Can you remind us of that?
It's a long story, but the meristem knows how long the days have been as a result of proteins that transmit from the leaves to the meristem. It is a protein, isn't it? Or is it the RNA? I can never remember. Yeah. But and so the leaves know how long the days are, in a temperate plant at least, and tropical plants not really known because the days don't change. Yeah, and they send a signal to the meristem that basically changes its whole pattern of gene activity.
So what happened to plasmodesmata, right?
Yeah, there's not enough of them to make a big difference in this, according to at least Eric Kramer's calculations. He calculated in root cells, but they're similar, that about 3% of the auxin flux could be due to movement of auxin through plasmodesmata, and the rest would be through something like this. Now, there are also auxin uptake carriers, even though they're not necessary formally because the neutral auxin can go diffuse through the plasma membrane. There are also auxin uptake carriers, which are important in a respect to this that I'm not going to get to.
So is it fair to think that if there are no exporters, then it would be dominated by its passive transport through plasmodesmata?
That's what happens when you remove one of the exporters, the one that's important for moving aux around in the shoot apical meristem. There are others there too. This is the predominant one in the shoot apical meristem. Everything still grows because there's other members of this family. There are eight members of the auxin efflux carrier family. If you remove one, you eliminate the flowers.
Okay.
It's if you remove all of them, nobody's ever removed all of them, but if you go as far as five of them, you get a plant that's about that big, and it's really messed up. Enrico Scarpella has done that. He's gotten to the quintuple mutant. Beyond that, I don't think it would be alive. So they're really pretty important. Okay, so the auxin efflux carrier, we make a mutant in pin one, this one particular auxin efflux carrier, we don't get our flowers anymore. So that tells us that the floral primordia get their spacing due, at least in part, to transport. Yeah?
Is the transport of auxin that you showed in a couple of slides ago, is it really one-dimensional?
Yes, it's two-dimensional.
It's two-dimensional, so it does...
In the meristem, it's only in the epidermis that we're talking about. There's no pin 1 or very little pin 1 in the cells beneath the epidermis, so the auxin doesn't move around down there much.
Okay, and so it does dilute. It does dilute as it's spreading.
Well, there's plenty of it there already, and it's being synthesized all the time. So I don't think it's diluting. It's indeed the sites of synthesis are the new flower primordia. But that's irrelevant because it moves around a lot faster than synthesis. So transport dominates. And it's two-dimensional. That's the part I said I wasn't going to talk about. The reason all the auxin ends up in the epidermis also is that the epidermal cells express very high levels of auxin influx carrier, so that any auxin that comes from the lower tissues ends up getting sucked up into those cells and then moves side to side in those cells by pin 1, the directional auxin efflux carrier. The influx carrier is not directional. There's also another set of auxin transporters, ABC family auxin transporters. It's not as simple as I'm making it out to be. We can see which direction the auxin efflux carriers are in by doing some microscopy and image processing, where we label the pin 1 protein green and the plasma membrane red, and we can see which side of the membrane the exporter is on, and so we know the direction of auxin flux. And if we look through, or you can just look at the arc of the thing, you can infer which direction the auxin is moving. And if you look at the formation of a new primordium and look at the direction in which auxin is moving, it's quite lively. And it moves towards a new primordia at first, and then eventually it reverses and moves out of the new primordia. So there's a lively traffic of this pin 1 protein, which is moved from one position in the cell to another by vesicle traffic. So the old pin 1 gets moved to a new location. What's the rule when we look at this? Well, if we look at all these cells in the shoot apical meristem and we try and find out how it is we can predict which side of the cells will have the auxin efflux carrier, the answer is that the auxin efflux carrier is always on the side of the cell where the neighboring cell has the highest auxin concentration. How do we know this? Well, we can do double duty with our pin 1 green fluorescent protein reporter here, because pin 1 is a strongly auxin-induced protein. And so if you add auxin to a meristem, 30 minutes later, you have a ton of pin 1. And so you can look at the brightness, and that tells you where the auxin is at the highest levels. And you can look at the pattern in the plasma membrane, and that tells you which direction the auxin flux is. Yeah.
Thanks for bringing that up, because now it presents the problem. So how do we know how fast the auxin response is?
Yeah.
So is it a fast process or is it a slow process? Like the transcriptional regulation of auxin.
Oh, transcriptional processes are mostly 20, 30 minute-ish.
Okay.
The expansion, 5-10 minute-ish, and they do depend on transcription also, but transcription of very small proteins, the small auxin upregulated proteins.
Cool. And then the flow of auxin, I guess, is much faster than that? Is it also on the order of minutes or seconds?
It's happening all the time.
So if the cell produces more pin when exposed to more auxin, how long does that auxin peak last?
Oh, 30 minutes, something like that. It's activated within about 30 minutes. And on the downside, we have to do photobleaching because the GFP is more stable than that. But,
okay.
But yeah, it goes down somewhere around that, sub-hour. And then the weakening, 5-minute-ish transcription, 15 to 30 minutes,
okay.
An hour for pin 1 to go up and go down. You're already seeing the contradiction, because if I'm a cell with a lot of auxin, the first thing I do is I induce my auxin efflux carrier and I spit all my auxin out to my neighbors.
Exactly.
And now their cells with high auxin.
Right.
they weren't spitting much of their auxin out before, but now that they're high in auxin, they're going to, with some delay, activate their pin 1 and spit their auxin back to me again, and now I'm a high auxin cell again. I'll show you the differential equations. All right, so here's the model. Locally, high auxin concentration causes new primordia, and it gets high locally by transport and diffusion. We've established that. The auxin efflux carrier moves the auxin. Where's the energy come from in that? It comes from, you have to take a picture of that. We published this in 2006. But the energy comes from those proton pumps. It's the pH difference. Creates a chemical potential in the Gibbsian sense. And the proton pumps burn ATP. The auxin efflux carrier moves auxin, and its gene is auxin-induced, so the rate of transport from a cell depends on the auxin level in the cell. And the auxin efflux carrier is polarized in cells and points towards neighboring cells with the highest auxin concentration. These are just observations. Can you make a model out of this? And the answer is yeah, if you just translate this into the language the plants speak, then you can have the auxin in cell I changing with time t, the amount of auxin minus its degradation plus, what are we looking at here? The transport of auxin into the cell minus the transport of auxin out of the cell, influx and efflux. And this is movement between the cell wall and the cell, and this is the wall getting loaded up from adjacent cells. This here is what's happening in the wall between cell I and J. This is the amount of pin 1, which is proportional to the amount of auxin. We used a Hill equation, of course. And then the direction of pin, which is proportional to auxin concentration. Pin from cell I pointing to cell J is proportional. The amount of pin is proportional to the amount of auxin in cell I, but the direction is proportional to the amount of auxin in cell J. And we make an artificial substrate where we've made the cells divide, and we crank this thing. So the yellow means more auxin and blue means less auxin, and we get the phyllotactic pattern right out of it in a pretty broad parameter range. The little green things are the vectors of auxin transport.
Is the Hill coefficient in those equations, or you just use less amount
already? No, it's just to make it so that they saturate it some, you know, in some reasonable way. That's all. It doesn't matter what the Hill coefficient is, as long as it's 3 or more, probably. It's just a way of making sure the process saturates, because otherwise it's not really chemistry. So it's an artificial way of putting in a zero and a saturation level. So we can get our phyllotactic pattern out, and indeed if we change the size of the meristem, we can get other non-phyllotactic patterns out too. So, all right, so it looks like we've got active transport of a morphogen. It's creating a morphogenetic pattern, but there's a problem here. There's a deep problem, which is this. The auxin efflux carriers polarize in cells and points towards the neighboring cells with the highest auxin concentration. But as I pointed out to you before, the auxin receptors in the nucleus, and all a cell knows is its own auxin concentration. How does a cell know the auxin concentration of its neighbors? Here's a guy that's old enough to remember, like me, to remember the old Woody Allen comedy routine, where he says he was thrown out of college for cheating in his philosophy class. I looked into the soul of the guy sitting next to me. Well, that's what these cells are doing. We'll get to it. Any questions before I give the answer? Yeah.
Is the activity of a proton pump sensitive to turbo pressure, or somehow?
Not that I know of. Not that
There's
I know
no
of.
There's no connection between.
Sensitive to auxin. Auxin activates the heck out of it. But I know of.
Makes me think, you know what, how do you coordinate? So turbo pressure that eventually will drive growth, right, to the way you pattern it.
We can come back to that. But the answer to that is every textbook says that turbo pressure drives growth. I could demonstrate to you that that's not true.
But it's required.
We can come back to it. No, not always. I could come back to it. Sometimes turbo pressure drives growth, but that's not all that's happening. Think about the shape of a pavement cell. How does turbo pressure do that? That's growth. There's no way turbo pressure could do that, because the cell's got projections and it's got indentations, and the cell only has one turbo pressure. Don't believe everything you read in a textbook.
So the Turing ideas are complementary to what we're seeing here in the Borish-Raymond sense, or?
In the Borish-Raymond sense, the mathematics here would be similar to the mathematics of reaction and diffusion, but there's no inhibitor, and there's no, and it depends on active transport, not diffusion. So in the Meyerowitz sense, Turing was just wrong. Completely, utterly, absolutely wrong. In the Schramm sense, yeah, the equations have some vague resemblance, and so he must have been right in some higher plane.
I never said that Turing explains float axes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. But.
I don't think
you have said that, yeah, you have said that that these transport mechanisms fit into a Turing framework, which is correct, I think.
So is the spacing between these local maxima accurately predicted by these assumptions here?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the rate of acceleration is it's determining it in our model, and so probably not what's really happening in the plant, but who knows. Yeah?
So is it fair to say that the absence of high levels of auxin is also important for development?
Sure.
So how does that impact, I guess, this model?
Well, if the relative concentration of auxin determines where a primordium is, if you don't have lows, you don't got highs. That's all.
Right.
But and the model is really pretty artificial, of course. It's also the case that at really high auxin levels, cells don't expand, and at low auxin levels, it's only middle levels where you get this expansion, if you actually read the acid growth papers.
Okay. But then, I guess, looking at maybe differentiation, what if you need to lower your auxin levels so that you can exit this stem cell-like state. I don't know if that's what's happening, but that's just kind of a hypothetical example. All right, so you can either say, I'm a cell, I need to increase my auxin so I can do something, or you can say, I'm a cell, I need to get rid of my auxin so I can do something.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I think you could look at it either way. That's very good.
Yeah.
Yeah, very good. All right, so how is it that a cell knows the auxin and its neighbors? The answer turns out to be this, that since auxin weakens the cell walls at certain levels, the primordia are growing faster than their neighbors. And this is something Eric Miosis can tell you about next week when he gets here. And so the orange, it's a heat map of the movement of nuclei away from each other, where we've removed the dividing cells and just put the nucleus in a position between any dividing cells so that we can use the nuclei as fiducial points for growth, and we get more growth where the primordia are and where the auxin is at high levels. And so that these cells, now remember, this is where we get to the part that's different with animals, because these cells never slide with respect to each other. They never crumple or don't crumple or bend much, and I mean they can do, but they never slide with respect to each other. So they're all fixed in place. So you have some cells that are expanding. Their walls they share with their non-expanding neighbors are under a huge amount of stress that results from the turgor. So when you're next to one of these guys, you have a highly stressed wall. Our previous prediction would be that that would cause you to have a ring of microtubules around the primordium, and you do. I'm not going to show it, but you absolutely do. And that's what eventually gives rise to those borders. So if you ablate a cell like we did before, this hole should expand a little bit, and we should have high stress on the walls behind where we poke a hole, because the hole should expand. And we can see here we've laser ablated these three cells. And you can watch the pin 1, hour, move to the back of these cells, and then to the back of these cells, which are the most highly stressed walls. So it's mechanical, and the pin 1 goes to the plasma membrane adjacent to the most highly stressed wall. Somehow a cell is comparing all its sidewalls and sending vesicles full of pin 1 to the one that's adjacent to a stressed cell wall.
So as much as I love mechanical feedback, as explanation for everything. I wonder if you have to invoke it in order to get your effect on pins. And so,
no, there are other possibilities.
And one possibility would be that, right, of course, there are pins inserted in both, you know, so from both sides, And if you just have a local suppression or enhancement in the same cell, you can generate this positive or negative feedback as needed. You can make it local.
No. I mean, you could. You could have things like efferents or notch delta going from one cell to the other.
No, I think you can do it completely locally, but we'll do it in the
back. Okay, let's do it. Yeah, let's do it.
Can I ask a clarifying question? So you're saying you can have a uniform distribution of PIN and just locally activate it? There's a paper that kind of tries to argue that in the roots, where you have a kinase that activates PIN and can cause it to start moving auxin. But I think in the roots, pins are polarized, right? In leaf tissues, it's less clear.
Early leaves, it's interesting. And the veins are forming down deep in the leaf. And the epidermis of the leaf, it's highly polarized.
It's
early
leaves. No. How early?
Super early, yes. That's how it gets up to the tip. That's how it gets to the tip. Oh, yeah, well, after that, it's gone, sure. This isn't happening in a leaf, is it?
Well, yeah. So Fred Sack showed that there's a correlation between levels of PIN and what might be differentiation of the meristemoid into a GMC into a stomata. So that's, and then also looking at DR5 and D2V as other reporters of auxin levels. So if auxin levels are important, and it may not be important in that process, right? But if it is important in that process, and you don't have polarized pins, then how else would you do it if not locally activating pins?
I mean, you could do. The pinoid is probably the kinase you're talking about. There's others, AGC kinases.
Yeah, right, exactly, AGC kinases.
That also have polar localizations and could be, but they always seem to have the same polarity as the pin, though. So they're always there with the pin. It's like the myosin stuff we were talking about before. It's you don't see uniform distribution of PIN in those cases.
So if I may suggest, that it really looks to me like maybe something that really merits special discussion, and we can come back to that. And would 5 or 10 minutes suffice?
Yeah, I won't get through my third topic, but I'll get through this one. One thing to point out is you can test this theory in non-invasive ways, and we just put a Sepharose bead with some cellulase on it here to weaken the wall right at that point, and all the pin 1 starts to point out away from the weakened spot because we've created circumferential tension around that spot. And when we wash the bead off, we start to get a different phyllotactic pattern. We've shifted it.
If the spacing between the local maxima is at least partly a function of the cell division rate, then do you have a prediction as to what happens, if this is even ever a realistic scenario, in an undividing epithelium, if you induce a local concentration of auxin? Or is that not a realistic scenario for plant growth and therefore not necessarily interesting to consider?
What we've seen when we've stopped division by depolymerizing the microtubules is that the cells just blow up like balloons. They get really big, but we never waited long enough to see if it would change the phyllotactic pattern, actually. They're probably dead before. Now, the flowers come out about once or twice a day. They're not coming out real fast, and so that the cells would have to stay alive for that long. They might. We never looked. It's a good question. Nice question. We never looked. Yeah?
I don't understand one thing. So what you're saying is that the localization of the PIN receptor is actually the localization of the receptor in a piece of membrane.
Mm-hmm.
It's the local properties of the cellulose of the extracellular space. And that happens because you have auxin now locally there.
No, it's that we've dissolved the cellulose for the cellulose enzyme, so we've weakened the wall.
That's what I mean.
And so the stress is moving the location of the efflux carrier.
Understood. But what I don't understand is what makes different the membrane of the sending cell and the membrane of the receiving cell, because they both experience the same thing.
That's a good question, and it merits a separate discussion. But basically, the way we modeled it in this case is that the dead cell can't have any PIN1, and so the first cell puts the pin 1, I mean, where there's a junction with a dead cell, there's no pin 1. That's how we modeled it, and so it has to go to the backside. Now, whether it goes to the front or the backside, it's an interesting question. We're working on the paper right now. I think we have the answer. It's a very good question. And you're the first person who's ever asked it in an audience I gave, because it actually is a big hole in the theory. Any event, here's the summary of this part, that auxin causes cell expansion. So also, we can reduce the turgor pressure, and this goes away. We don't get the auxin peaks under low turgor pressure. So the resulting mechanical stress controls auxin transport. New auxin peaks changes which cells are expanding, thereby changing the auxin flow again. And so another novel developmental mechanism of regulated transport of the morphogen. And we modeled, in this case, we modeled the two sides of the wall as being separately weakenable, which is probably a little artificial. We could come back to it in a much longer discussion. Okay, one thing to say about the mechanism, just for a piece of fun, is that Drosophila ring discs do this too if you poke them. They get calcium waves that go across, and this is a whole shoot meristem with a calcium wave and a little refractory region behind it, a crescent. We understand it reasonably well, this response. And if we block this response with, say, lanthanum chloride, the pin 1, in this case, what we've done is poked a hole, and then we add lanthanum chloride. Now we've pre-treated with lanthanum chloride. Then we poke the hole, and the pin 1 doesn't go anywhere. Then we wash the lanthanum chloride away, and the pin 1 becomes circumferential to the hole. So this early calcium response, which is mechanically induced, is necessary for the much later pin 1 response, though we don't know why. It's not the vesicle traffic, because you can poke the hole, then 5 or 10 or 15 minutes later, treat with lanthanum chloride, and the whole response goes normally in the presence of lanthanum chloride. So it's something about the initial signaling leads a calcium spike, but we don't know what. There's much more. Now, of course, there isn't normally a needle that pokes a meristem before a flower gets made, as in the case where we showed our calcium transients. If you actually look at the meristem, it twinkles with calcium all the time, and indeed oscillates with calcium levels every 20 minutes. If you watch for long enough, you'll see a calcium wave go across the whole meristem. It's hard to see in these lighting conditions. There it is. And so this... Now, whether this is mechanically disposed or not, we don't know. But if it is, there's some very lively mechanics going on here that we can assess by confocal microscopy and looking at calcium. But we haven't yet proven that this is mechanical. We could go on about the meaning of some of this. By the way, this calcium response is completely unnecessary for the microtubule response. It happens perfectly well when we calcium response one way or the other. The calcium comes from the cell wall, by the way, because we can use extracellular chelating agents and prevent the calcium response.
When you, so the tinkering, does it have some specific domains of activity, like where the primordia is?
No, it doesn't seem, not that we can tell. We really haven't added it together over long enough times to be sure, but we haven't seen that. We have not seen that.
And when you block the tinkering, does it change the development at all?
Yeah, we don't get any pin 1 movement, and we don't get, I mean, you can't block it for very long, the plant dies.
Plant dies, okay.
Sure, after about 10 or 12 hours, it's dead. Yeah. We can wash it in and wash it out and prevent the response for, 8 or 10 hours.
So but
if you just leave it on, it's dead within a pretty short period of time, yeah. All right, so I guess I've used up my time. We're not going to get to the third topic. But I do want to point out one thing at the end, I mean, that had to do with the mechanism by which the microtubules were being regulated and the fact that the cell wall also controls cell division. But I do want to point out one thing here at the very end, is that while everything you heard about Drosophila is wrong when you look at a plant, because none of those things is happening, there are also other organisms, or none of the things I talked about are happening. This is an alga called Caulerpa, which has, as you can see, roots, stems, and leaves, but it's all one cell. So the control of cell division is irrelevant. The shape of the leaves and the shape of the organs hasn't got anything to do with cell division patterns or anisotropic expansion of cells, except maybe this one cell. And so there's other organisms that don't follow any of the rules I talked about today. And this is a petri dish, you know, however wide a petri dish is, a few inches. It's a completely macroscopic organism. That's one cell.
You have multiple nuclei, right?
Yeah, lots and lots of nuclei.
And they, so genetically speaking or protein speaking, you have compartments. They're not compartments because there's no wall.
There's no wall.
But
no plasma membrane.
But there's a difference between this area in the cell and this area in the cell in terms of
With a subtle enough principal component analysis, you can see some differences in the RNAs in different regions, but not a lot.
Not a lot.
Not so far, no.
Actually, I have to really
okay, we have to call it off.
Moratorium on further questions, because Elliot is here, and you can continue discussion, more questions. But the students will have to start in the lab at 1:30, right? And Elliot, you're between...
everybody at lunch, I realize that.
So, but, are you done?